A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it starts with a pair of cracked traffic wands. You know those illuminated baton things airport ground crews wave around? He ordered two from AliExpress for a Purim costume. Novelty purchase, nothing mission critical, and they arrived already cracked, just shattered in shipping. And his question is basically, that's annoying for a costume accessory. But what if you're ordering 10,000 units of something plastic that actually matters?
The answer is not buy better plastic. The answer is you specify it. Drop resistance is a spec, not a feeling.
For a $2 novelty wand, a crack is annoying. For a medical device housing that's been dropshipped across three continents, a crack is a non-starter. It's a recall, it's liability, it's a supply chain that just ate itself.
The traffic wand is almost a perfect case study in what not to do. Thin walls, sharp internal corners, cheap as possible resin, and then you put it in a padded envelope and send it through 5 sorting facilities. Of course, it arrived cracked. The surprise isn't that it broke, it's that anyone expected it not to.
And yet almost nobody outside of industrial purchasing has the vocabulary to say, I need this thing to not shatter when it gets dropped. We don't even know what we don't know.
And Daniel's question gets at exactly that gap. He's asking, if I wanted to buy something plastic that could actually survive shipping and handling, where would I even start? What do the professionals look at? And that cracked traffic wand, it's a perfect case study, because whatever it was made of, it failed at the single most predictable stress a shipped product will ever face.
Which, when you say it out loud, is sort of absurd. The one thing you can absolutely guarantee about a package in transit is that at some point, someone or something is going to drop it.
Plastic is the problem word here. It's a category, not a property. It's like saying metal. You wouldn't order metal bolts for a bridge and hope for the best. You'd specify the alloy, the grade, the heat treatment. That's the entry point into a whole world of material science and procurement specification that most people never think about. What does it actually mean for a material to survive a drop? Why do some plastics shatter and others bounce?
Most people are Daniel, staring at a cracked traffic wand and wondering what went wrong.
Let's get precise about what drop resistance actually is, because it's not the same thing as strength, and people conflate those constantly. Strength is how much force a material can take before it permanently deforms. You're pulling on it or compressing it and asking when it yields. Hardness is surface level. Can you scratch it? Can you dent it with something sharp?
That's the gap, isn't it? Between plastic as a generic label and the engineered reality of materials that can absorb 10, 20, 100 times more impact energy before they fail.
A drop-resistant material absorbs it. It takes the hit and converts that energy into heat, into tiny internal deformations that don't compromise the whole structure. A brittle material can't do that.
Where do we even start? If you're someone who needs to order plastic parts that won't arrive as a jigsaw puzzle, what's the first thing you need to understand?
You need to understand what's happening inside the material when it hits the ground. That's the short version, yeah. And here's why the distinction matters. You can have a material that's extremely strong, but catastrophically brittle. Glass is the classic example. Enormous compressive strength, you can stack tons on it, but one sharp tap on the edge and it shatters. Certain plastics have the same problem. Polystyrene, what disposable cutlery and CD jewel cases are made of. It's reasonably stiff, it holds its shape, but drop it on a hard floor and the energy just rips through it.
Absorbing energy sounds gentle, but we're really talking about what breaks first, the floor or the thing you dropped.
When a plastic part hits concrete, the energy has to go somewhere. If the material can deform, not permanently, but enough to spread the impact out over time, the peak force stays low and the part survives. Orders of magnitude difference. And if you're a procurement officer ordering 10,000 units of something, plastic is about as specific as saying metal. Are we talking aluminum or are we talking titanium?
It's not just about strength. It's about whether the material gives itself time.
The factory used whatever granulate was cheapest that week, probably a generic polystyrene or a low-grade acrylic, and shipped it. And that's the whole procurement story in one cracked wand. If you don't write impact resistance into the spec, you don't get it.
The vocabulary gap is the whole problem. Most of us don't know there's a number you can put on a purchase order that means this thing survives being dropped.
There are several numbers, actually, and they come from standardized tests that have been around for decades. But that's where the material science really starts. Impact toughness as a measurable property, not just a vibe. Hit it fast, and they can't move in time, so the material behaves like it's brittle, even if it's technically a ductile polymer.
Which is why a drop test isn't the same as just pushing on something with your thumb.
You take a rectangular bar of the material, you machine a precise V-shaped notch into it, and then you swing a weighted pendulum hammer through it. The notch concentrates the stress. It's a controlled weak point that guarantees the fracture starts right there.
Which brings us back to Daniel's question. If you can't just squeeze a sample and know whether it'll survive shipping, what are you supposed to do?
Units are joules per meter, or foot-pounds per inch if you're still in the imperial world. You can't put tough plastic on a purchase order and expect to get the same thing twice.
Because one supplier's tough is another supplier's. We had some leftover polystyrene in the hopper.
The notch standardizes where the crack begins, so the number you get back is actually about the material's resistance to crack propagation, not about how smooth your sample surface happened to be. Same category, completely different universe of performance.
The professional bias problem isn't really about materials at all. It's about translation. Turning this needs to survive being dropped into a set of numbers that mean the same thing to a factory in Shenzhen and a warehouse in Rotterdam.
They give slightly different numbers for the same material, but they're measuring the same fundamental property. Charpy is more common in metals. Izod dominates in plastics. You'll see Izod on material data sheets for pretty much every engineering thermoplastic.
What do the numbers actually look like? You mentioned polystyrene shattering like glass. What's its Izod score?
Around 20 joules per meter. It's terrible. Acrylic, PMMA, same neighborhood. These materials have no mechanism for stopping a crack. At the molecular level, the polymer chains in polystyrene are these stiff, glassy structures.
Let's get inside the plastic. When that wand hit the floor, what actually happened to the molecules?
The stress concentration at the crack tip just rips atomic bonds apart one after another, and the fracture propagates at roughly the speed of sound in the material. That's what makes it so catastrophic. It's over before the rest of the part even knows it's been hit.
The crack moves faster than the material can react.
That's exactly the right way to think about it. Now compare that to ABS, acrylonitrile butadiene styrene. Izod values typically 200 to 400 joules per meter. That's 10 to 20 times tougher than polystyrene. And the reason is right there in the name. The B stands for butadiene, which is a synthetic rubber. ABS is a copolymer where you've got these tiny rubber particles dispersed throughout a styrene, acrylonitrile matrix.
The difference between shattering and bouncing is literally whether the spaghetti can wiggle.
You're converting impact energy into heat through viscoelastic deformation. Below TG, you've got frozen spaghetti. Hit frozen spaghetti and it snaps.
Which is why polycarbonate is magic and polystyrene is a disaster.
Polycarbonate doesn't need rubber additives. The polymer backbone itself is tough because the chains can undergo large-scale molecular motion under stress. The carbonate groups in the chain give it enough flexibility that the material can yield locally ahead of a crack tip. You get what's called shear yielding. Instead of a sharp crack, the material forms these tiny cray zones that absorb enormous amounts of energy before they fail.
PLA. The stuff everyone's 3D printing with?
TG around 60 Celsius. At room temperature, it's already below its TG. Drop a PLA print and it shatters because the chains are locked up. Your desk is colder than the material's glass transition, so the material behaves like glass.
You said earlier that speed matters too. A material that bends slowly might shatter under a drop even above its TG.
The mechanism here is different again. The polyethylene chains are so long, millions of repeat units, and they're so heavily entangled with each other that pulling them apart requires unthreading this vast molecular knot. Every entanglement is a point of resistance. The energy required is enormous. That's the stuff in high-end body armor and the bottom of dump trucks that get pounded with boulders all day.
We've got this spectrum. 20 joules per meter on one end, over 1,000 on the other. And somewhere in that range is the number that means this traffic wand would have arrived in one piece.
But here's the thing. The Izod number tells you about the material, but it doesn't tell you about the product. A traffic wand isn't a notched bar in a lab. It's a tube with a handle, a circuit board inside, maybe a lens cap. The way it actually fails in shipping depends on its geometry, how it's packaged, what angle it hits the floor. That's where ASTM D5276 comes in, the free fall drop test for shipping containers.
Walk me through what ASTM D256 actually looks like in a lab.
You take a rectangular bar, typically 63.5 millimeters long, 12.7 wide, about 3 thick. You machine a precise V-shaped notch with a radius of 0.25 millimeters at the tip. You take the packaged product, not just the item, the whole shipping box, and you drop it onto concrete or sometimes steel plate. The standard specifies drop height based on package weight. For a 10 kilogram box, it's typically 76 centimeters, which is roughly the height of a conveyor belt or the tailgate of a delivery truck.
That notch is doing what my traffic wand's sharpened turtle corners did.
If it's cracked, it fails. That's the system level test that matters. That's why notched Izod values are always lower than unnotched. The notch is a stress concentrator, and stress concentrators are where cracks start.
When Daniel's wand hit the warehouse floor, the impact found the sharpest internal corner, and that's where the crack began.
The Izod value was probably down in that 20 to 50 joules per meter range. A single drop from waist height onto a sorting facility floor would have put more energy into the part than the material could absorb. The crack initiated at some stress concentration, probably the edge of the lens housing or where the handle meets the tube, and propagated straight through. The geometry was working against the resin at every level.
5 to 10 joules is what? About 4 to 7 foot-pounds?
They're buying the cheapest granulate, running it through a mold, and boxing it up. The specification chain was broken before it ever started, and that's the difference between consumer e-commerce and professional procurement in one sentence. Knowing the material property is only half the battle. In the real world of procurement, you don't just pick a material, you have to make sure you actually get it.
I said that.
You did, and it was the right word. But here's what I want to flag about Izod testing. It's useful, but limited. You're testing a tiny, standardized bar with a machined notch, which has degraded mechanical properties because the polymer chains have already been through a heat cycle. The molecular weight drops, the entanglement density goes down, and your Izod value can fall off a cliff.
Passing an Izod test doesn't mean the bot survives a drop.
Not just polycarbonate, but something like Lexan 943A, Izod notched impact 800 joules per meter per ASTM D256. And then you back that up with a certificate of compliance, a COC, which is a signed document from the manufacturer saying this batch meets those specs. You take the item in its shipping box, lift it to a specified height, and drop it onto concrete or steel. Then you inspect for damage. It tests the system, part, packaging, everything.
That's what professional buyers use.
That's the enforcement mechanism. The supplier knows there's a real test waiting at the receiving dock, and suddenly the incentive to substitute cheaper material evaporates. It's a pass-fail test on the real thing, not a material coupon. You can have a material with great Izod numbers and still fail D5276 because your part geometry creates a stress riser that the Izod bar didn't have.
Now we know how to measure toughness in a lab. But if I'm a buyer, not a materials scientist, what do I actually put in a purchase order? What words make sure my parts don't show up like Daniel's wand?
UHMWPE is even more expensive, and it's harder to process. It doesn't flow well in injection molding, so you're often looking at compression molding or machining, which adds cost again. For a high-volume, low-margin product, the math gets real. If upgrading from ABS to polycarbonate adds 40 cents per unit and you're making 1 million units, that's $400,000. If your breakage rate with ABS is 2%, replacing 20,000 broken units might cost you $60,000. The polycarbonate upgrade costs more than the breakage it prevents.
The optimal material isn't the toughest one. It's the cheapest one that hits an acceptable failure rate.
That's exactly the procurement calculation. And acceptable varies by industry. For a toy, maybe 3% breakage is fine. You just ship replacements. For a medical device housing, the acceptable rate might be zero. For automotive, where a cracked connector could strand someone on a highway, also zero. The cost of failure isn't just the part, it's the recall, the liability, the reputational damage.
The material name is a family, not a guarantee.
It's a starting point, and even within the family, the trade-offs are substantial. Let me walk through the big four. This is the whole field of design for drop. Sharp internal corners are stress concentrators. They're basically built-in notches. Every time a part has a 90-degree inside corner, you've given a crack a starting line. Add a radius to that corner, fillet it, and the stress spreads out. Ribs are another huge lever. A thin, flat wall flexes and snaps.
The Riot Shield material has a kryptonite.
You can take a mediocre material and design it to survive drops that would shatter a poorly designed part made of something twice as tough. But it degrades under UV, turns chalky and brittle after a couple years outdoors unless you add stabilizers. A Pelican case and a generic hard case might both be polycarbonate, but the Pelican has internal ribbing, a gasket that compresses and absorbs impact, reinforced corners, and a lid that distributes load across the frame. The knockoff is just flat walls and sharp corners. Same material, completely different drop survival. A well-designed ABS part can out-survive a poorly designed polycarbonate part.
It's tough in the I'm not cleaning this up sense, not the it still works sense.
That's exactly the distinction. And then there's nylon, polyamide. Tough when dry, is at around 1 to 5 foot-pounds per inch depending on the grade, but nylon absorbs moisture from the air, up to 8 or 9% by weight in high humidity. This is one of those knock-on effect that bites people who only test at room temperature. Polycarbonate undergoes a ductile to brittle transition around negative 20 degrees Celsius. Above that, it's tough. Below that, the molecular motion that enables shear yielding freezes up, and it starts behaving more like polystyrene. ABS has the opposite problem. It softens and loses toughness above about 80 degrees Celsius.
The material's properties are a moving target.
A part that passes drop testing at a comfortable 23 degrees Celsius might shatter like glass at minus 20, or deform into a pretzel at 60. Polypropylene has a glass transition around 0 Celsius. Above that, it's ductile. Below that, it gets progressively more brittle. ASTM D5276 can be run with temperature conditioning. You soak the packaged product at the test temperature for 24 hours, then drop it immediately.
You need to specify not just the impact strength, but the temperature at which that impact strength is measured.
If the supplier's part passes at room temperature but fails at minus 20, you've got a problem that won't show up until your first winter shipment to Canada. A proper spec says something like, product in retail packaging shall survive 3 drops from 1.2 meters onto concrete at minus 10 Celsius with no functional damage and no crack exceeding 5 millimeters. That's a real requirement you can test against.
There was no material data sheet, no drop test, no temperature conditioning. The spec sheet wasn't a contract. It didn't exist. And the result was predictable.
That's the broader supply chain story. In professional procurement, the spec sheet is everything. Without it, you get whatever the factory has on hand, and what they have on hand is often regrind, or a cheap grade that barely meets the visual spec and nothing else. The cracked traffic wand isn't a story about a bad plastic.
Give me an example of a bad package.
Heavy product, thin single-wall corrugated box, no foam. The box deforms maybe 3 millimeters on impact, which absorbs almost nothing. Corrugated crushes at a constant stress, and if the product is dense, the box bottoms out instantly. First, ask for the material data sheet, not the marketing description, the actual MDS. Look for the Izod impact strength per ASTM D256. If the number is above 200 joules per meter, you're in probably survives shipping territory. Above 500, you're in rugged. Below 50, you're buying something that will shatter if you look at it wrong. The data sheet exists for any engineering grade plastic. If the supplier can't produce one, that's your answer right there.
The absence of the sheet is the sheet.
Second thing, write a drop test into the purchase order. Reference ASTM D5276. Specify the drop height. 76 centimeters for a 10 kilo box is standard and requires a certificate of compliance. That one sentence shifts the burden of proof from you to the supplier. They're now legally on the hook to prove the thing survives a drop, not just to ship you something that looks like the picture. Design matters as much as material. If you're designing the product yourself, add ribs, radius every inside corner, and consider a rubber overmold at the impact points, the edges, the corners, anywhere that hits first.
No, you're the one explaining to your boss why the medical device housings are cracking in the field.
A product with visible ribbing and filleted corners was designed by someone who thought about this. A product with flat walls and sharp corners was designed by someone who didn't. The contract manufacturer substituted a PC-ABS blend to shave cost, didn't update the impact spec because there was no impact spec, just the material name. First drop test at 1 meter, the housing cracked at the boss with the PCB mounted. The blend had half the notched izod and the sharp internal geometry at the boss concentrated the stress. The substitution was technically compliant with the purchase order because the PO just said plastic housing. That's not a supplier failure. That leaves us with a bigger question. We've got this whole vocabulary for specifying drop resistance. Izod values, ASTM, D5276, certificates of compliance, but it's still an industrial language.
The lesson is, name the material, name the grade, name the standard, name the number, name the temperature.
Test the package, not just the part. And if you're a small volume buyer, a hobbyist, a startup doing a first production run, you may not have the budget for full ASTM testing, so you pick materials with a wide safety margin. Two forces may be converging. The first is the EU's Digital Product Passport Initiative.
If you're actually ordering parts, not just browsing AliExpress and hoping, what do you do? I'm hearing four things.
The European Commission has been explicit that extended producer responsibility laws will require manufacturers to publish data on product lifespan and failure modes. Impact resistance is an obvious candidate for inclusion. Not tough plastic, not ABS. Write ABS, injection molding grade, meeting ASTM D256 notched, IZOD minimum 5 foot-pounds per inch at 23 degrees Celsius. That line is your insurance policy. That's the direction. And if the EU mandates it, it becomes a de facto global standard, because nobody's going to run two separate product lines.
Because they shipped you ABS. You just didn't say which ABS.
There are dozens, some with EZOD values of 2, some with 8. You're not buying a material, you're buying a performance envelope. The material name is just the address. The numbers are the contract.
That's step one. Specify the standard, specify the minimum, specify the temperature.
But the industrial printers are increasingly running polycarbonate blends, nylons, even UHM WPE. The question is whether on-demand manufacturing tilts toward tougher materials by default, because the producer is closer to the customer and breakage during shipping is less abstract. You need to spec load temperature impact testing, ASTM D256 at minus 20 Celsius, or you're qualifying a material for conditions your product will never actually see.
The packaging layer you mentioned, that's step three.
But the pessimist notes that AliExpress already proved you can sell cracked wands and stay in business. Waist height, concrete floor, 3 drops on different faces. It's not a certified test, but it'll catch the obvious failures before your customers do. A heavy item in a thin box with no foam will fail that test every time. 2 inches of polyethylene foam and suddenly the same item survives.
Step four is for the rest of us. The hobbyists, the small runs, the people who aren't writing purchase orders at all.
If you don't have a spec, buy a material that forgives you. Polycarbonate is overkill for most things, but it's the most forgiving thermoplastic you can get without going to exotic prices. It tolerates sharp corners, thin walls, bad design decisions. On the other end, avoid general-purpose polystyrene, crystal polystyrene, and unmodified acrylic for anything that will be shipped. Those materials have EZOD values below 1 foot-pound per inch. They're not designed for impact. They're designed to be cheap and clear.
The hierarchy is polycarbonate if you can afford it, ABS if you need a balance, polypropylene if flexibility is acceptable, and stay away from the brittle clear plastics unless you're hand-delivering.
That's the cheat sheet. And if you're 3D printing, PLA is brittle at room temperature. Its TG is around 60 Celsius, so it's already below its glass transition on your desk. PETG is tougher. But neither is going to match a molded part in a proper engineering resin. Additive manufacturing has its own impact challenges, and that's a whole other conversation.
To pull it together, name the performance, not the resin. Test cold, not just room temperature. Test the package, not just the part. And if you're small, buy something that forgives you. Where does this leave us? The Cracked Traffic Wand was a $2 lesson in material science. For professional buyers, the lesson costs a lot more, but it's the same principle. Specify the performance, not the name.
That principle is about to get tested in ways we haven't really grappled with yet. I keep thinking about additive manufacturing, 3D printing. Right now, drop resistance is mostly a material selection problem. You pick polycarbonate over polystyrene and you're done. But with additive, you can design impact absorption into the geometry itself.
Lattices and infill patterns that crush in controlled ways.
Gyroid infill, for example, distributes stress across a continuous curved surface. No sharp corners, no straight lines for a crack to follow. You can tune the infill density so the part crushes progressively on impact, eating energy layer by layer instead of shattering. That's not a material property. That's a design parameter.
Drop resistance stops being, which plastic did you buy? And becomes, how did you arrange the plastic?
That's both liberating and terrifying. Liberating because you can make a part tougher without switching to an expensive resin. Terrifying because now the spec isn't just a number on a material datasheet, it's a whole geometry that has to be validated. How do you write a purchase order for gyroid infill at 40% density, oriented at 30 degrees to the impact axis? We don't have standards for that yet.
We barely have standards for the recycled stuff, and that's already in the supply chain.
That's the other thing keeping me up. A buyer specifies 100% post-consumer recycled PET, thinking they're doing the right thing environmentally. But recycled PET isn't one material, it's whatever went into the recycling stream. Different grades, different additives, different levels of chain scission from thermal history. One batch might have an isod of 3, the next batch 1.5. Same specification on paper, completely different drop resistance.
You don't know until the parts start cracking.
There's no ASTM standard yet for certifying impact performance of recycled feedstocks batch to batch. You can test each lot when it arrives, but that's expensive and slow. The industry is working on it. Proposals for tracer additives that survive recycling and let you verify the original grade, but we're not there yet. So right now, if you spec recycled content, you're accepting variability in impact performance whether you know it or not.
Which circles right back to Daniel's wand. The factory used whatever was cheapest, and cheapest meant brittle. Recycled feedstocks can mean exactly the same thing, just with a green label on it.
The wand wasn't an anomaly. It was the default outcome of a system where nobody specified anything, and that system scales. The same logic that gave Daniel a cracked novelty item gives a hospital, a cracked equipment housing, a mechanic, a cracked tool case, a soldier, a cracked radio shell. The stakes change, but the failure mechanism is identical.
The whole episode has really been about one thing, closing the gap between what you assume and what you write down.
That gap is where every cracked part lives.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the year 868, Chinese astronomers observing from the Kuril Islands recorded a transient lunar phenomenon, a bright flash on the moon's surface lasting several seconds. Modern analysis suggests they witnessed a high-velocity impact event whose optical flash was briefly visible to the naked eye, making it one of the earliest documented observations of lunar impact fluorescence.
The moon got hit by a rock and glowed.
That's one way to think about impact events. The moon survived. Daniel's wand didn't. Specify the performance.
This has been My Weird Prompts, thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flemingdop. If you want more episodes, find us at myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back soon.
Until then, check your inside corner radii.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the
the close from sloth, from man, from long ear hose, my windbombs. Until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.